The Planet Rock Podcast with Sky Talk. Find a Sky Talk pack to suit you with inclusive calls to UK mobiles. Search Sky Talk.
Hello, I'm Paul Anthony and welcome to the Planet Rock Podcast with Sky Talk. Coming up, we got the very best bits of chat and exclusive rock and roll interviews from Planet Rock, including an archive interview with Keith Richards. Also on the podcast...
What the hell is he thinking?
Yes, Alice Cooper is here, putting the world to rights as usual. We got the Hairy Bikers talking about a bit of this.
I'm a lover, not a fighter.
And a bit of that.
Are you fornicating in your veggie garden?
We'll hear from original Thin Lizzy guitarist Eric Bell, plus Justin Hayward on My Planet Rocks.
Playing cricket with an empty champagne bottle and a rolled up beer can.
Thunder's Danny Bowes has more of your wonderful emails.
Okay, Vivian, I'll go with it.
And we spoke to Pink Floyd drummer Nick Mason at the launch of the new major Pink Floyd retrospective at the V&A Museum in London.
A way of explaining to people a bit about how recording technology works and how it's developed.
But first, let's kick off with the Rolling Stones' legendary guitarist Keith Richards explaining here how he once got a smack in the face from his hero Chuck Berry.
He once gave me a black eye.
No way.
Yeah, I was backstage at a gig of his. And Chuck was in his normal, by that time, mode of the little black bag, get the money and run. And he'd left his guitar out on the in his dressing room, and I'd been sitting there, I just picked it up. He walks in, nobody touched it, boom! You know, but he didn't know it was me. A few months later, I get sort of these apologetic, Keith, I didn't know. It don't matter. Chuck, you did the right move. You know, I wouldn't let nobody touch mine either. You know, I could have been stealing it, you know.
Yeah. But you've picked Let It Rock for us to play.
Because of its effortlessness. And it wasn't, you don't hear this one a lot, but it has all the ingredients of Chuck Berry in it. And incredible guitar solos, a very innovative drum beat going on behind it that nobody has to know about. That, it, you know, if you're a musician, you pick up on these things, and that he was using. And what I learned from Chuck Berry, that pick your drummer. If you're doing stuff like Chuck Berry and I do, which is rhythm guitar, the drummer can ruin it if he ain't on, which is why I have Charlie Watts, you know, and which is why Chuck Berry had Eddie Harding and Francis Clay. And to me, it's like the epitome of how, you know, rock and roll should sound. You know, it's got edge on it, it's got incredibly powerful beat, but at the same time, it's like, yeah, that's just normal. Nobody's like angsting about it or grinding or making like faces and like, you know, it's just goes like this, you know. I love that effortless way he slings some solos on there. There's three guitar solos on there and they're all beautiful. And it's a great little story about some guy trying to get out the way of the train. And there's always a little story with Chuck. He's a great storyteller.
And now it's the man who dies on stage several times a show. Nights with Alice Cooper, only on Planet Rock.
That was Money for Nothing by Dire Straits. Apparently Mark Knopfler asked ZZ Top's Billy Gibbons how he could replicate Gibbons' guitar sound for that song. Billy didn't tell him how, but Mark came pretty close anyway. Billy Gibbons has that, I think what it is they wind those humbucking pickups so hot. Mike Bloomfield told me one time that he had a Telecaster that he had the pickups wound so hot with copper that it made the guitar so, it could feed back just by touching it. And he could keep the sustain going forever on that thing. Anyway, if you want to replicate the sound of my radio show, send an email to my lawyer at alice@nightswithalicecooper.com. I saw Blue Cheer, who was called the loudest band in the world. Would they have like 15 amps apiece? And they played with a band called The Electric Flag, which was Mike Bloomfield and some of the guys from Paul Butterfield. And Bloomfield had a little twin reverb amp and a Telecaster, and his tube amp was sitting on a Samsonite folding chair. And he was louder than Blue Cheer. And Blue Cheer was loud, but Mike Bloomfield alone, just his guitar, was louder than the entire band. It's amazing. You're listening to Nights with Alice Cooper. The only thing you'll be replicating is a copyright infringement lawsuit, mister. Yeah.
One way or another, I'm gonna find you. I'm gonna get you. One way or another, I'm gonna win you. I'm gonna get you. One way or another, I'm gonna see you. I wanna meet you. One day, maybe next week, I'm gonna meet you. I'll meet you.
That was Blondie with One Way or Another. Blondie was one of the first punk bands to have pop success. They played CBGBs with bands like the Ramones and Television, but their songs were much lighter and mainstream. The Talking Heads was another group that came out of the scene. I kind of thought it was sort of minimalist rock, and it was sort of that period of time when anybody, even if you didn't have an immense amount of musical talent, could be in a band. I think that that's refreshing, that you would get people that weren't necessarily great players. In our era, you had to be a great player. You had to have a great voice. You had to have great songs. You had to have an image. You had to have all this in order to sell records and go on tour and become a star. When the punk scene came along, it was sort of like the license for any kid to get in a band, and you don't have to be that good. You play rock that you can play at your level. And to me, the whole deal was as long as you meant it. If you were angry and your lyrics were dumb and the music was dumb, but you were angry and you were letting people know, that's what I think was really cool, that the punks were really just letting themselves be known. All right. The Talking Heads was another group that came out of that scene. Now, they were much more sophisticated. Like Devo, they were way sophisticated and certainly couldn't be called punk. Personally, my scene has to be heard to be believed. I still go with the old thing of you have to write your best songs. You have to sing it the best, and you have to play it the best.
It's Nights with Alice, only on Planet Rock.
It's once again time for Alice's Fun and Freaky Facts, which I'm sure is the most exciting part of your whole day. You poor sap, you. Here we go. The Roman Emperor Commodus gathered all the dwarfs, cripples, and freaks he could find in the city of Rome and ordered them to fight each other to death in the Colosseum with meat cleavers. What? What? What the hell is he thinking? And where is that on tape? Mothers were originally named Mama or Mommy because they have mammary glands. Well, probably they have memory glands too. They remember their mammaries and their mammies. Play-Doh was originally meant to clean off wallpaper. And the wallpaper guy had so much fun cleaning up the wallpaper, he says, I'm going to put this out and people are going to love it. And he was right.
If you've ever burnt the spuds, or used sugar instead of salt, or set your oven on fire, you're safe now. Si and Dave's Sunday Roast Amnesty.
On Planet Rock.
If you are a crappy cooker, we can make you a perfect practitioner of the culinary arts. This is from Caroline Lambert, and the subject is Sunday Roast. Message, hi guys. I need steak advice. My hubby loves steak and I love to cook what he likes. I can't get it like in restaurants though. It's always chewy no matter how I cook it. Have you any foolproof ways to properly cook a good cut of steak? My hubby would be ever so grateful. Many thanks, Caroline. Oh yes, we can sort out steak. There are a lot of golden rules. We've done this before on telly a few times, so you must have missed them. First thing is, if you can afford it, buy good native British breeds. That means not rare breeds, it's just beef that's bred for beef. So get good steak. Bit of marbling's always helpful. Look at it. If it looks marbled, it's good. Thing is, about if it's been hung for a while, that means it's old, like 21 days, 28 days. It really does help it. It really makes it more tender. We did an experiment once where it was the same herd, so effectively the same steak. We ate a steak that had been hung for 1 week, and we had a steak that was hung for 3 weeks. Same barbecue, same fire. Honestly, the difference in the 28 days, it was a completely different steak. So get stuff that's well hung and aged. But actually, if it says aged, it can be chemically aged, so you've got to watch it. So first tip is, never, ever, ever cook your steak straight from the fridge. Always bring your steak to room temperature. So just let it relax, warm up. Anyway, what I do is I rub oil, salt and pepper onto the steak. I don't oil the pan and put it on a griddle. It's fine. Now, there's two schools of thought this. One school of thought is that you should only flip it once, but Heston Blumenthal, he says keep turning it. Me, I'm a flip it once man. But then, you know, like you leave your joint of beef to rest? I would leave the steak to rest for 5 minutes somewhere warm. It relaxes and it's lovely. And actually, if you're cooking fillet steak, sear it on all sides and finish it in a hot oven. That's how Michelin-starred chefs would do it, and that's how you should do it. Treat it like a mini joint. It's brilliant. So that's a few tips, and I think that'll keep you going and satisfaction guaranteed. Next week, we might do chips. That was Gods of War, Def Leppard. Oh, talking of Gods of War, that reminds me of last year when we were in the Baltic and our DNAs were revealed. Do you remember that? We were on Odin's Mount, you know, and Kingy was sure he was a Viking because he looks like a Viking. He's from Newcastle. I mean, he's played on being a Viking for the past, like, 50 years. Me? I don't know what it was. I thought it was an all-sort. You know what I mean? Bit of a mixture. Anyway, we had our DNAs done. And the professor came up to us on Odin's Mount, the god of something. And he brought two envelopes out. And he says, I'll do you first, Si. And when did Si's first? I knew that his was boring and mine was dead interesting. Si, you're not a Viking. And you see his little lip quivering. He said, you're in fact Swiss German. He said, with a little bit of Italian. And all he said was, the Italian's all right, but I'm not so sure about the Swiss and the German. I was just laughing. I started going, ooh. Then he went, Dave, you are a Viking. Pure blood Nordic descendancy. And Kingy says, well, how come you look like a rabbi? I said, but I am not, I'm a Viking. I am a god of war, but I'm a lover, not a fighter. Anyway, an email. This is an email from Emma Poat. I think it's pronounced Poat. If it's not, I'm very sorry. The subject is second anniversary request. Message, on the 26th of July, my husband Richard celebrated our second wedding anniversary. Now, from that line, it says that Richard celebrated it, but you don't sound too sure. Do you know what I mean? Anyway, I'll carry on. On Sunday mornings, we listen to you whilst we are working on our allotment. There are always cuddles in the cucumber and kisses in the curly kale. Oh. And kisses in the curly kale. Have you boys got a hairy allotment? I bet it would be fab, full of giant marrows and stuff. Thank you. Well, Emma, yes, we both got gardens. King is in Northumberland. He's got some raised beds. But in France, I've got a massive potager, which is French for vegetable garden. So much so that we had to get help in. But my wife does most of the gardening. Not because I'm lazy, it's because she's better at it than I am. But it is wonderful. She grows it, I cook it, and it's great. What have I got in at the minute? My beans are coming out. What I did this year as well is, this amazed me. This is all down to my wife. You know, like where you get ballotti beans and haricot beans, dried beans? How did they get like that? It's easy. You leave them out there on the tree, in the sun. Then you pod them, and you've got dried beans. And the best thing in the world is, you know, I make like, oh, it's like a tuna fish and ballotti bean fish cakes, but I use my own beans. I want to do like a lamb stew with haricots, but they're my own beans. It's brilliant. It's good growing your own. Well, you know. No, it is amazing growing your own food. The wonder of it, you know, it's fabulous. So, yes, no giant marrows. Courgettes are good, but what I always do is like get the courgette flowers, because you always see them in books, these stuffed courgette flowers, but you can't really buy courgette flowers. But the funny thing is, you go out there, wanders, all yellow splodges all over your courgettes. I've got courgette flowers. I stuff them with like this little veal stuffing and just deep fry them. Oh, they're gorgeous. But sometimes I go out in the garden. I've got a lot of Swiss chard this year as well, and that's lovely, cooked with parmesan and white wine, just chopped, and oh, it's good. Oh, well done, Emma. But, you know, I don't know. Be fornicating in your veggie garden. I mean, I don't know, really. Mrs. Myers, summer's coming, and there's, you know, could be harvesting in September.
UK. You rock.
Planet Rock.
Planet Rock.
On Planet Rock, my guest this week is original founding member of Thin Lizzy, Eric Bell. It's been a pleasure speaking with you about Tales of Excess, and of course, good luck with the new album, I am sure will get the success it deserves. It's always good to hear stories from someone who's been down, who can come back up and talk about it from a positive point of view rather than doing it from a hospital bed or a home.
So, I know.
It seems appropriate to finish with All Right Now, because everything does seem to be all right now. How good a song is this? Because I think it's been used on just about every TV commercial soundtrack known to man, probably.
Well, I've got, I don't know whether I'm out of time, but I've got a story about this as well.
Go for it.
I was in, as I say, I did the tour of America with Noel, and we were in Los Angeles, and we had about 5 gigs cancelled. And our manager said, right, boys, you can either stay in LA or we're going to take you to San Diego. What one do you want to do? And I was seeing this lovely groupie at this point in time. I said, oh, I want to stay in LA, yeah? All right. So that was that. So the next day I got a phone call in my suite. And I picked it up. This English guy, excuse me, you out of the Noel Redding band? I said, yeah, I'm the guitar player. He says, can you do me a favour? Said, what's that? He says, I'm from Backstreet Crawler, and we're on a tour at the moment, and we've got Paul Kossoff with us, but his arm's broken. His arm's in a sling, and he's got a guitar player standing in for him. But he walks out on the stage and waves at the crowd to show that he's actually there, right? He says, but can you do me a favour? If Paul asks you, have you any dope, no matter what it is, can you tell him you haven't got any? We're trying to clean him up. I said, yeah, sure. So about 2 or 3 nights passes, and I went to this club with this groupie that I was saying, Amy. And anyway, we came back and we walked into my suite, and there was about 25 people in my suite. And it was these guys playing cricket with an empty champagne bottle and a rolled up beer can. And I looked around and Paul Kossoff's sitting over there on this couch. And I went, ooh. So I walked over to him. I says, really pleased to meet you, Paul. I'm Eric Bell. And he turned out a really nice, really pleasant guy. Mm. I thought he was going to be a real weirdo. Really nice guy. We ended up in my bedroom, on top of the bed. Both of us, myself and Paul Koss, I've only met him about half an hour, and we're both lying on top of my bed talking about anything and everything. And I started saying to him, you know something, Paul? So many guys in Ireland really rate you as a guitar player, and look at you. And he went, yeah, I know what you mean, man. Really nice bloke. And about 4 or 5 days later, we left LA and we went to San Diego or somewhere like this. And myself and Noel, we were playing that night in a university, and we went into the kitchen of the university, which was vast, to try and get a cup of coffee somewhere. And this guy came in and said, hey, man, have you heard the latest? And Noah says, "What? What's that?" "Paul Castles just died." And Noah said, "We were with him 4 nights ago at the party." "No, man, I'm sorry, he's dead. He passed out in the plane." You know?
Wow.
So every time I hear that record, this goes through my head.
Well, it's a poignant and classic song to finish with. It is free all right now. It's been My Planet Rocks with Eric Bell. Eric, thank you very much. All the best for the new album, Exile. And
thank you, sir.
Catch you on the next cycle.
There she stood in the street, smiling from her head to her feet. I said, "Hey, what is this? Now, baby, maybe, maybe she's in need of a kiss." I said, "Hey, what's your name, baby? Maybe we can see things the same. Now, don't you wait or hesitate. Let's move.
It's My Planet Rocks. My guest this week is member of the Moody Blues, Justin Hayward. So what were your influences? What got you into effectively rock and roll, rock, blues, etc.?
You know, when I was a small child, I remember hearing on the radio a guy called Johnny Ray, who had a kind of cry in his voice. And I think he did a song called Cry, actually. He had a wonderful kind of break in the voice, and it always appealed to me. And then also my family had a very strong faith, so I was familiar with the tunes and the melodies from the New English Hymnal, which always resonate with me. But when I heard Buddy Holly, now my whole life was changed, really. And I was able to focus on exactly what I wanted to do.
What was it like at that time? Because I can't imagine what it was like in 1968 hearing Led Zeppelin for the first time, just like I can't imagine hearing Elvis or Buddy Holly for the first time. But try and put it into context. What was it like, those kind of life-changing moments of an icon that had never been heard or seen before?
Well, they lit up our world as young people, and particularly Buddy and the Everly Brothers. Elvis was a legend, of course, when he came along. And we'd seen these people in their pictures in the paper and heard them on the radio now and again. But, you know, I was too small, my late brother and I. You know, we were only kids, 7 or 8, when Buddy and Elvis came along. But we'd heard them on the radio, and we could imagine what they were like, but I think it just lit up our world. It put a different dimension into our world, and I think the beginnings, the birth of rock and roll in the mid 50s was hugely important to, obviously, to my generation. But then we had to wait quite a long time for real English heroes. We had Cliff and the Shadows in about 1960, but still we had to wait until the Beatles in 62. Before we knew that the whole world was going to be different musically.
When you saw Buddy Holly, did he make you want to be a singer, a guitarist, or both?
Well, it's the fact that Buddy was all three. He was the writer and the singer and the guitar player. I knew as a small kid, and when I got my first guitar when I was 10, so that'd be about 1956, 57, and I knew that I was never going to be like Elvis, to be able to stand out the front of a group and perform like that. But as soon as I saw Buddy, it all made sense to me, because he could be in the group, not be a sort of flamboyant personality, but write the songs and sing as well. And it was a revelation. I think it changed a lot of people's, the way a lot of people thought about music.
You've chosen a Beatles song, Paperback Writer, which is effectively a song about someone writing a book.
Yeah.
Did the Beatles, in the same way Buddy Holly sort of changed things for you, because it was on our shores, a British perspective, did they sort of make you go, wow, this is game-changing?
Well, I remember being at home in Swindon, it would have been 1962 or early 63, where I grew up, and I heard Love Me Do on the radio. I can distinctly remember it, going out of the house and walking down the street and thinking, my life is going to be totally different now because the Beatles are in it. I knew that, just from one record, I knew that they had a lot more to offer, and of course they did. They weren't particularly welcomed at the time. I remember there was a chap called Steve Race who seemed to do a lot of music stuff on the telly and on the radio. And he was very insistent. Oh no, they'll never last. You know, no, that this, that their kind of music will, you know, never catch on. And I thought then, I really don't like you. Because the Beatles meant so much to me. And then I was privileged and lucky enough only a couple of years later to come to London and be part of this scene in London then in the 60s and when the Beatles arrived here.
Yes, sir, oh, madam, will you read my book? It took me years to write. Will you take a look? It's based on a novel by a man named Lear, and I need a job, so I want to be a paperback writer.
Danny Bowes, Life and Rock.
My intro turned it out in a darkened room and slightly confused, but originally I was going to say I was going to do it in a dress because it reminded me of the great story of Ozzy Osbourne apparently having all his clothes taken away by his wife because he was drinking so hard. And so out of sheer desperation, he put one of her dresses on, walked to the bar and said, "Can I have a drink, please?" And it really made me laugh. Legendary story. Apparently it did happen. Fantastic. I don't know whether I'd have the guts personally, but there you go. Although I have worn a dress. New Year's Eve, 91. Me and Luke. We won't go there. Well, perhaps we will later on. Okay, let's have a new tune. This is Highly Suspect and Blood Feather. And I have now a pocket money pick from Vivian Neal in Hatfield. Bear with me. This is quite long, but I think it's good. So she says, "Hi, Danny. Remember when we were starved of music news and the sight of our favourite bands were rare? Well, I remember waiting for seemingly years for the release of Led Zeppelin's Physical Graffiti. I went into my local record shop and asked endlessly. I was hoping to hear something on the old Grey Ouzel test, or about when the album might be released. And I was amazed to hear the first track, Finding My Way, from Rush's first album, Rush. I knew I couldn't wait. And though Geddy Lee sounded like Mr. Plant..." What? Eh? "Geddy Lee sounded like Mr. Plant..." Okay, Vivian, I'll go with it. "Geddy Lee sounded like Mr. Plant, and that was enough for me. The following day, I scoured the house for every single Green Shield stamp available." "Remember them," she says. "I turned the house upside down and found sufficient to fill the right number of books, as money was tight, and paid something like £2 for the privilege of that fine album. Nothing beat the 96 bus ride home and removing the album from the LP-shaped carrier bag. I can smell it now." Yeah, see, I can as well. "Yes, eventually I did buy Physical Graffiti, but that Rush moment still gives me pleasure all those years later. Cheers. Saw you live on a number of occasions, including Plymouth, which was another night never to be forgotten." Ah, so Vivian basically ended up desperate to buy Physical Graffiti, but bought Rush instead, and then bought Physical Graffiti afterwards. Amazing. Well, there you go, Vivian. Thank you very much for your note, and let's have it then. This is Rush, Finding My Way.
It's here. Planet Rock.
Planet Rock. Planet Rock. Planet Rock. Planet
Rock. Arnold Lane had a strange hobby.
Nick Mason, it's wonderful to talk to you in the setting of the Victoria and Albert Museum. Even more exciting to know that you and Pink Floyd are going to be here next May. How did you react when the V&A first put this idea to you?
I thought it was really exciting. I keep mentioning the Bowie exhibition because I thought it was so good, and I actually thought, oh, be great if we could do something like this. But it hadn't actually occurred to me that V&A would be interested in us, because I'd looked at it. Bowie had all those costumes and so much material and had been through all those sort of changes. You don't perceive your own work in the same way. So it's great when someone goes, oh, no, no, we've got a lot of, we could do this, we could do that.
And in terms of, you know, it's going to be 50 years since Arnold Lane was released, when this exhibition opens, you didn't stand there as a 20-something thinking, oh, in 50 years it'd be great when I'm talking about my career. Now that you are, how does that feel?
Rather strange. It sort of seems to have slipped by, really. What's so bizarre is most of the people I know, my contemporaries who had proper jobs, have all sort of retired and gone and done other things and so on. So I'm feeling a bit sort of conservative, really.
This is going to be about music technology, it's going to be about art, it's going to be about design. In terms of you and David and Roger coming together to collaborate on this, how do you manage that? Because the three of you are spread all over the world and you do lots of different things.
We see each other now and again, but actually what's so good about this is that the V&A is a very good sort of central point. There is an enthusiasm from everyone to do this.
What were the things that you really wanted to be in this exhibition? I know you can't list me everything, but maybe a couple of things that you thought, you know what, they cannot not be in there.
Obviously my drum kit.
Well, we'll be without that.
I think for me, the thing that I would most like to see is a way of explaining to people a bit about how recording technology works and how it's developed. And to some extent, our relationship with Abbey Road, perhaps. And because, yes, there's stage designers, lighting designers, graphics and all the rest, but actually the sort of engineering staff in the recording studios have played at least as great a part, and it'd be nice to maybe recognise that and explain how some of that has worked, and you know, all the things that someone like George Martin did with the Beatles that were then transferred to us and so on. So it's an opportunity to recognise actually the sort of great British recording industry
and a great British institution, which is what you've become, if that's okay.
I suppose so.
Nick Mason, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
And that's all for this week's Planet Rock podcast with Sky Talk. You've enjoyed listening to our best bits. We'll be back next week with more from our Planet Rock guests and presenters, so do join us then. Remember, you can listen to Planet Rock via your DAB radio, online at planetrock.com and via our Planet Rock app. Or you can listen on your telly on Sky Channel 0110 or Virgin Channel 924. And don't forget, you can listen to me every weekday morning on Planet Rock Breakfast. See ya.
All the best bits of Planet Rock in our weekly podcast with Sky Talk. Love to rub it on for hours? Search Sky Talk now to find a pack to suit you.